This is OBG Project's Grand Rounds Live, a podcast of the OBG Project's monthly webinar featuring cutting-edge OB and GYN topics. Our Grand Rounds Live webinar is free for OBG First members. With an OBG First membership, you have access to the webinar slides, handouts, and future Grand Rounds Live webinars. To learn more about membership and other perks of an OBG First membership, go to obgproject.com/get first. Enjoy the webinar.
Hello, and welcome to the OBG Project's Grand Round Live for September. Today, we're going to be talking about how to prep for PrEP, reviewing the latest guidelines from the CDC on HIV prevention and how to integrate it into your practice. I am so excited to introduce our two experts today, and you may recognize them from our related entries section. They are the masterminds behind our HIV Resource Center that you can find on the OBG Project's website. So today we have Dr. David Malebranche and Ariel Watrys. And so I have the utmost pleasure to introduce both of you to our OBG Project Grand Rounds Live. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Please feel free to go to the next slide. If it can come back up so we can see it. Looks like it. Share screen would be great. These are our disclosures. Thank you so much. You can go to the next slide. So here's what we're going to talk about today. We are going to very briefly review some HIV background information. We're going to talk about PrEP and the options that we have at this point for PrEP. We're going to talk about incorporating it into various types of practices and then have an opportunity at the end to answer questions that you may have. Please go ahead and next slide. Next slide. So certainly the landscape of HIV has changed significantly in the last number of years, 20 years, 10 years, 5 years. And we can spend lots of time, not today, another time, talking about the role that PrEP has had in that. But it is very important to appreciate that there are certain communities within the different areas that we're looking at that are still struggling with HIV rates. This first slide is showing us HIV incidence rates among folks who are over the age of 13 within certain race and ethnicity groups. Next slide, please. This one is looking at it by different types of transmission, looking at specifically, predominantly first, we're looking at male-to-male sexual contact, and then below that we see heterosexual contact, below that we see injection drug use, and then the combination of certain types of sexual contact with IV drug use, and you can appreciate where the contexts are that there are still components that need to be addressed, and the importance of sexual health in the context of addressing this. Next slide, please. And then finally, looking at the age component to this clinical space and appreciating where we are seeing reductions in numbers and also where we're seeing increases. And predominantly, I want to draw attention to the 25 to 34 year old group, which is an important group to be aware of. Next slide, please. Next slide. So we are talking about establishing a new clinical practice in a time, specifically now, if we appreciate the clinical setting that a lot of us are working in, is incredibly tight for time. And so we have to acknowledge that context. It is important to appreciate that a lot of us are trying to rush through other clinical concerns that our patients have, and that there can be components of this that might feel initially that they are not necessarily attainable. But there are a lot of ways to introduce talking about PrEP and engaging on PrEP in a program format, but also in a context where it's being brought up and normalized regularly to allow for the lack of time that we have so that there's more space as we move forward to develop that trust. It definitely requires more screening and more conversations around sexuality and also STI testing. If there are interruptions in our clinical spaces, it can make it incredibly hard. And then the last one is probably one of the most challenging ones, the by the way component. If we have someone who has a clinical situation that you're dealing with, or if you're trying to engage around their sexual health and then something else comes up that's much bigger, that can definitely play a role. David, is there anything else on this you would want to address?
No, sometimes though, you can as a clinician, like I'm an internal medicine physician, you're a nurse practitioner. We see people for primary care all the time, and then it's one of those things where we finish with the visit, and then as we're walking out the door, someone will say like, "Hey, I have this
By
abscess
the
on my
way,
buttock," or "Yeah, I'm
yes.
having vaginal discharge," and you didn't get that information at the beginning, so it makes it difficult to have these sexual health conversations at that time.
Definitely, definitely. Next slide, please. As we begin the conversation around sexual health, we need to appreciate the context that we're working in and the evolving context around everyone's expression and comfort with their own gender and their own sexuality. These are two very different entities. We could actually both happily sit and talk about this slide for a very, very long time. It is a fabulous resource to have and to appreciate the nuances around sexuality and also gender. Gender is the representation of someone's identity in the gender spectrum, and then their sexuality has to do more with their sexual orientation, who they're interested in sexually. These are two different spaces. They are wide, beautiful spaces. And being comfortable to understand the differences between those as a provider is incredibly helpful. And the context in the tool as a tool for you talking around HIV prevention, it is only an asset, but it definitely comes from a space of understanding the differences between those things first, and then having the opportunity to talk to your patients about them, because it can definitely be a space where people may not feel comfortable bringing it up to a provider, but if a provider shows that they're comfortable talking about it, it can definitely offer a space that is inviting to talk about sexual health and also HIV prevention. But this is a really good source of just to review how gender identity, all of these different components, expression and then attraction and emotional attraction can all live on these beautiful spectrums, and it can help understand the nuances of what people are coming in with around their sexuality and their gender. Next slide, please. In that vein, it is important to appreciate the space that we need, especially in clinical settings, to confirm people's pronouns. And at this point, the language has shifted. It is shifting a lot around preferred pronouns and pronouns. We have moved away from saying preferred, it's just pronouns at this point. And pronouns can change, which can definitely be a challenge to kind of keep up with. But just confirming pronouns, if you feel comfortable sharing yours, definitely that is a good starting point as well. I try to do that with my patients. And some people can sometimes have more than one set of pronouns. David, is there anything else about this one that you wanted to bring up?
No, I think that's a great point. I think sometimes, providers have different ways to approach things. And
Definitely.
I may not always start with saying my pronouns with every patient. And some populations, especially if your population is predominantly like cisgendered heterosexual women, then they may look at you like, why are you asking me that? But I tend to, defer to them like, how would you prefer to be called? Or what pronouns do you use instead of preferred? It makes it sound like a choice when you say preferred. More so than
Exactly.
like, when you just say, what are your pronouns and what can I call you? It invites a space in. And even if, you don't have a substantial proportion of your patients who are on a spectrum of gender identity like that, it makes everybody feel welcome and doesn't alienate anyone. It's a great
Yes.
point.
Yes. And also, what pronouns do you use? The ones that they use for themselves. That is your metric for that. And that can, as I said, it can change and it can be a little hard to keep up with, but in the context of the clinical space, just checking in and being like, any changes with name, any changes with pronoun. And that's a really easy way to kind of streamline it in that space. Next slide, please. So within the context of we've talked about pronouns, we've talked about the importance of making sure that we're comfortable talking about these things. We are all humans, and we are all coming into the space as providers with our own experiences of sexual history and our context around that. And we have to be mindful that we are engaging people on a topic that they're not always comfortable talking about at first, but definitely have high need to talk about. And so being mindful as we're stepping into that space to remain neutral about our own stuff and leaving our baggage outside, creating a space in that clinical room or in that clinical phone call or Zoom at this point that is inviting for them open-ended questions. I feel strongly, and I think David would probably say the same thing, about explaining why you're talking about what you're talking about and not just to jump into very direct questions about genitalia, but just to kind of explain what the approach is, what you're looking to do to review. I love the comment, fix your face, you know, just being mindful of your reactions to things that you're hearing. If it's something new that you're not used to hearing about, you can ask for clarification. There are certain things I remember I heard for the first time from patients, and I'd be like, tell me more about that, and just kind of kept my face, you know, as neutral as I could. You know, some of the disclaimers that are listed here are certain styles that may not feel right for you, but they may feel perfect for you. I definitely like saying, you know, if I need to ask some questions, they might feel a little weird. But if you don't want to answer them, you don't have to. I'm only asking them to help me give you the best care. David, what are one of yours that you like?
Yeah, I kind of say I'm about to get in your business. I'm going to ask some personal questions. I'll say we ask this to everybody. Actually, patients had told me, I'd heard on the street back when I worked at Grady Hospital here in Atlanta that, you know, folks talked about me as I was the doctor that got in everyone's business. So yeah. I kind of like took that on. I was like, okay, I'm going to leave that as an intro. But I think your point is such a good one that, you know, we just need to prepare people like that. You don't shift gears from like, how often do you smoke, drink, or use drugs? And then, oh, hey, do you prefer anal or vaginal sex when you're having sex? Like, to just jump into that, some patients will be like, whoa, what are you talking about here? So to have that transition statement, whatever works for you is great.
Yeah. And I had the nickname at a previous job as the below the waistologist, right? So you develop, David and I have those reputations of being very comfortable talking about these things. And we have different ways that we get into that space with people, but it's very respectful and directed at the patient the entire time. Next slide, please. These are some questions that you can ask around sexual behavior. And, you know, there's a lot of debate right now about the term risk and using and how we are approaching the conversations, and a lot of movement away from using very heteronormative languages. So these are some really good approaches, and they incorporate the 5 P's, which if you're familiar from the CDC guidelines around sexual health, they talk about incorporating these different components to addressing someone's full, a comprehensive approach to someone's sexual health. So you're asking about partners. There's a lot of movement away from, do you have sex with men, women, or both? It's like we need to kind of broaden that a lot. What are the practices? What are things that you do? What kind of sexual contact do you have? What are you doing for protection from pregnancy or from STIs or from HIV? What are your pregnancy plans? Do you have any? Any previous STIs, past STIs, and pleasure? I think you added that one. That's a number 6. That wasn't necessarily on the CDC one, but it's a fully important one.
And I think people can add their own piece to it. Like the CDC doesn't have the monopoly on these P's, but it doesn't include pleasure, which is predominantly the reason, predominantly the reason why folks have sex is to have pleasure. It's not just for procreation or anything like that. See, I'm doing the alliteration thing right now.
I know you're doing it on purpose. I love it.
Right. But I mean, also somebody mentioned to me that they would add pronouns onto those P's as well. So we've always made a plea to the CDC to stay away from like pathology and those kind of particular phrasings. Ooh, I'm using a lot of P's here. And you know, that's one of those things that you can incorporate. But I think this slide kind of gives you a general picture of what kind of questions you need to be asking.
Right. And a lot of providers also will really just talk about anatomy in the context of what parts, another P, are being used for certain sexual contact, to really move away from gendered language, which is very inclusive and very directed in that sense. Next slide, please. So we're going to switch a little bit now, talking about PrEP, and then David's going to take it from there. But these are sort of the basic guidelines, directions for who would be a good candidate. So someone who is HIV negative, who has a partner who has HIV, and someone who has a negative HIV test and also has specific components in their lives that we want to make sure that they have as much protection as they can. Again, you know, we use the term risk factors. There's a lot of conversation happening around the word risk right now, but still in this context, it definitely applies. So we're looking at folks who have sporadic, inconsistent condom use, a history of STIs, incarceration, exchange of sex for money or housing, et cetera, any use of illicit drugs or strong ETOH dependence, and sexual partners of unknown HIV status with any of the risk factors that were listed above. Next slide, please. This, again, is another slide that I think the two of us could talk about for a very long time. There's a lot here, and I'm just going to kind of overview it so we can make sure to have enough time for the rest of the great slides. It is really important to appreciate that the decisions that someone makes around their sexual behaviors is not completely, you can't just fit it into one little box of risk. It's important to appreciate there are a lot of components that will play into someone's general health picture and how they engage in their health and what's going on that will direct some of the decisions that they're making. If we look at the picture below here, this there are so many things to consider when we look at where HIV is more prevalent and the different components in the different parts of the country of health access. I know a little bit later on, David's going to talk a little bit about very specific communities that we are very aware of having higher concern for HIV. And this is a very important thing to appreciate, that we can't just assume that somebody can just jump onto a medication. There may be other factors in their lives that are determining what they have to make around decisions around their health. Anything else on that? On this one for you, David?
No, this is from a great resource called AIDSview.org, which kind of looks at a lot of demographic information and puts it into geographic, spatial, and visual regards there. So a lot of times it's not just whether someone has sex without a condom or not, or how many people they have sex with, but also has to do with the density of the HIV prevalence wherever they live. So certain zip codes may have a higher prevalence. So it's not just who you are and what behaviors you engage in, but where you're actually engaging those behaviors. So it could be sexual networks, it could be a zip code. So the chances that you'll come across someone who is living with HIV and you may be exposed may be greater. That's why we say it's not always a risk thing per se, as far as putting it on the individual, which historically we've done with HIV prevention and HIV treatment. But it's not only what you do, but it's kind of where you're doing these things as well.
I have a very transient population at where I work, and this is a very big part of the conversation that we have. It's like, who are you doing? Who are you? What are you doing with who and where? Basically, that's what I was trying to say. So it's an important, like, the context is vital. Next slide, please. I think this is you.
Yeah, so these were the PrEP options. This is kind of an overview, and for some reason it didn't translate too well in the import because there were different colors. So on that top bar that you're seeing, FDA approved in July 2012, that should be FTC and TDF or Truvada. It's a daily pill. It's indicated for men who have sex with men, transgendered women, and cisgendered women. You can see below that, that's Descovy. I think magically, thank you, whoever's doing that, is bringing it up into the space right now. But Descovy was approved just about 2 years ago. It's also a daily pill. Of note, and we'll get into this a little bit later, it's indicated FDA approved only for men who have sex with men and transgender women, because those were the populations who participate in the study. It wasn't recommended or isn't recommended for cisgendered women. So that's an important distinction that we'll cover a little bit later. Also, as a prevention tool, in June of 2019, the United States Preventive Services Task Force issued a grade A recommendation for HIV PrEP. Why that is so important is that it makes sure that commercial insurance companies and also Medicare, Medicaid will pay for some of these things similarly to how they cover things like mammograms for certain age groups that are recommended, colonoscopies, flu shots, those kinds of things that are seen as kind of tried and true prevention standards. It is important for people to understand that HIV PrEP is now part of that landscape as well. Okay, next slide. Oh, that actually looks better. That was the way it was supposed to look, but it's all good. This is technology in 2021. Next slide, please. Okay. So this is a slide directly from Gilead and their website. Important to note that Truvada, FTC, and TDF, this was a medication that we've been using to treat people living with HIV since 2004. And it is indicated as in this combination, it's two medications in one pill. It's used in combination with safer sex practices for pre-exposure prophylaxis to reduce the risk of sexually acquired HIV in adults and adolescents over 35 kilos who may be considered at high risk, like we talked about. And again, the indication is based on clinical trials. It can be taken one tablet once daily with or without food. It's important to note, and when you prescribe this to your patients, the with or without food means that it doesn't matter whether you have a full stomach or not. The absorption is going to be the same. However, with potential of someone having some mild side effects like stomach upset, nausea, anything like that, it may make a difference. So I tend to tell people, I don't know, Ariel, if you do the same. I tell 10 people when they're first starting to take it with food.
I do the same thing. Yes.
Yeah. All right, next slide, please. So these are just some of the supportive studies. And again, Truvada or FTC-TDF has been out since 2012, FDA approved. And this is just a list of some of the studies that have supported that. Next slide, please. The main take home of this graph is if it works, it works if you take it. And this kind of, when you're looking at this dot, this kind of dot chart that you're seeing here, the y-axis is mentioning percentage effectiveness in reducing HIV risk. And the x-axis is looking at percentage of participants samples that had detectable drug levels. And the dots represent different studies, clinical trials that have been done. And as you can see, there's kind of a linear increase in correlation that the more you take the medication as it's prescribed, one pill once a day, 7 days a week, the more effective it's going to be. In other words, it works if you take it. So we can't give everyone kind of this messaging like you can take it every other day, you can take it every third day, something like that. And there were some follow-up studies from the initial PrEP slides with TDF and FTC or Truvada that basically stated that, you know, optimal is going to be 7 days, take the pill once a day, every day a week for 7 days. But the kind of cutoff that they found out where the effectiveness really took a drop off was if patients took it less than 4 days during the week. So that's an important distinction to recognize. Anything else, Ariel, that I didn't mention on that? Does that sound good?
That sounds great. Nothing to add.
Okay. Next slide. Okay, so potential side effects. Some of your patients, and especially if you are OBGYN and you're practicing with predominantly a cisgender heterosexual female population or woman population, a lot, it hasn't been marketed. And that's been the complaint that I've heard a lot, is that for cisgender women, they say that's that gay drug, right? And so they're not wrong in thinking that because it has been marketed for gay men for such a long period of time. So people don't know what the side effects are. And there's a lot of misinformation on social media. What I can tell you, and what Ariel can probably back up as well, commonly, the most common side effect I see is nothing. People say they tolerated it just fine. If they do have mild symptoms, it's headache, maybe some mild abdominal pain or discomfort, and sometimes weight can be decreased. Renal toxicity is very, very rare compared to what you see on social media platforms with some of the advertising that you see. Decreased bone mineral density is about 1%. And a hepatitis B flare, it's important to note that both FTC as well as TDF are effective in treating chronic active hepatitis B. So if you have someone that's HIV negative, but chronic active hepatitis B positive, and you put them on Truvada, and then they decide to go off at a certain point, pulling them off can actually induce an acute hepatitis B flare. So you may want to be careful about that. And then also to watch out for drug interactions. When you look at Truvada, it's actually excreted renally through the GFR and also with tubular secretion. It will not be impacted by cytochrome P450 medication. So those kind of drug interactions you don't have to worry about. If you do have some transgendered women in your population, one of the concerns from transgender women that I hear about a lot is, will Truvada actually impact my hormones? And will it reduce the effectiveness of my hormones? The short answer to that question is no, it will not. However, it works on the flip side, that the hormones may actually cause Truvada to have lesser levels in the bloodstream. So you have to encourage, if you have transgender women that are on hormones like estrogen, spironolactone, and some of the others, that they definitely need to make sure they're taking the medication every single day to ensure its effectiveness. That sound about right, Ariel? Anything to add?
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought up the hormones. I was thinking about that. And I will say that, as you said, if there are any side effects, they're usually fairly mild, and they don't usually last more than a couple of weeks after someone has initiated. It's not something that they're going to deal with in a prolonged course. It's simply usually when they're starting the medication, it can happen. But other than that, it usually clears out pretty quickly.
Absolutely. Okay. Next slide, please. All right. So these two slides, and they're not reading too well, but and I won't go over them. This is looking at a whole laundry list of the studies for FTC and TDF for PrEP. So Truvada for PrEP. These are studies that were with men who have sex with men, cisgendered heterosexual women, zero different couples where one partner was living with HIV, one partner wasn't. You can see this is looking at both adverse effects in the first slide, and the second slide looks at creatinine elevation. And what the main point of these two slides that are kind of lumped into one, I'm sorry about the overlapping graphics at the bottom, but what they're talking about here is that it's not really that much of a difference between Truvada with regards to these adverse events and creatinine elevation when you compare it to placebo. So you're seeing something where, you know, a lot of people may be talking about concern of, well, look, are these things, am I gonna have these kind of side effects, adverse side effects, kidney malfunction, so on and so forth. I hear a lot of concerns from the community that they've heard about liver abnormalities. And I can tell you, in 9 years of prescribing Truvada for PrEP, I have not seen one person that I've had to take off because of liver problems. But for some reason, that urban myth has kind of lived in the community. But just long story short, it has a good safety profile, regardless of what you hear in the major media. Any other comments on that area?
Just that the urban legend with my population is the bone health. And so it's the same thing. I've been prescribing also for 9 years, and I don't have any patients with that issue.
Right. And I will say, anyone who's watching us right now, there is a chat feature in here. So if you do want to ask a question, because we're going to leave some time at the end to answer some of those questions. If you think of something right now, go ahead and put that in the chat now. Next slide, please. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about TAF, TAF, FTC, or Descovy for PrEP. Next slide. So I love this slide because it's a great visual image of exactly how PrEP is working. And on the top in that gray bar, you have TDF. That's the component in Truvada. On the bottom in the blue is TAF. That's the component in Descovy. It's important to note that both of these medications are prodrugs. So they have to be converted into the active form of tenofovir into the cells. And so what you're seeing at the top is that for TDF, the majority of it is converted to the active form, probably about 60 to 70% is converted to the active form in the bloodstream, actually before it gets into lymphocytes to exert its effect on HIV and inhibit the enzyme that it uses to reproduce itself. Whereas with TAF, 90% of it actually doesn't get converted until it gets into the lymphocytes. So why this is important is because when you look at the potential for side effects, whether it be bone or kidney, part of the reason why there's a lot of concern, and we've seen some low evidence of abnormalities with TDF as opposed to TAF, is because more of it is converted into the active version in the bloodstream. And so this is a great pictorial representation of this and kind of why we talk about Descovy being a better version, because it actually doesn't get converted to the active form of the drug until it gets in the T cells to exert its effect. Next slide, please. All right, and this is the Discover trial where they actually compared Descovy to Truvada, and Descovy for PrEP was found to be non-inferior to Truvada at a point of 96 weeks. The treatment outcomes were consistent across the groups, and the main take-home message was that stressing adherence was the key. And so you can see here, they say that 99.7% of Descovy participants remained HIV-free at 96 weeks, as compared to 99.4% on Truvada. When you look at this, I think any of us with a prevention tool would be like, oh my God, 99.4 or 99.7, yes, please, we'll have either of these. And we'll get into a little bit more of what the specific differences of as you choose between the two of them, because these are the only two FDA-approved options that we have right now. Next slide. Okay, so I love this slide that was created by Julia Marcus, who's over at Harvard School of Public Health, I believe, and an absolute public health beast. So you're asking yourself as a provider, I've got two options for daily pills, TDF, FTC, or Truvada, TAF, FTC, for Descovy. Which one can I prescribe for my patients for PrEP? I want you to focus your attention to the left side of the screen. TDF, FTC, or Truvada is effective with all these populations that you see, men who have sex with men and trans women, heterosexuals, as well as people who inject drugs. You scroll down a little bit further from that bar graph, the effectiveness obviously for multiple population. The safety, you'll see small decreases in GFR as well as bone mineral density. And the cost is about $1,900 a month. However, there was a generic version approved last year. And if some of you are prescribing that, you've noted that some of the insurance companies, if you try to prescribe Descovy, they'll steer you to the generic version of Truvada. because they want to be able to not have to pay as much money for this medication. So that's Truvada in a nutshell. If you look at Descovy or TAF-FTC on the right side of this slide, the effectiveness is predominantly with men who have sex with men and trans women. We can't say for people who inject drugs or heterosexuals because we don't have the populations in the clinical trials that actually reflect that. So again, Descovy has only been approved, FDA approved, for HIV prevention for PrEP with men who have sex with men and trans women. The effectiveness is great. There's a better kidney profile where the GFR actually goes up. And so you see that as far as the safety, the only concerns that we've seen with Descovy, and it's primarily due to the TAF component, is a small increase in LDL as well as weight gain of a few kilograms, maybe 2 to 5 at the very most, but it can be concerning for a lot of patients. And then the cost is pretty comparable with this. So the take-home story from this slide is that you've got two options, and you need to have these conversations with your patients based on their age, their preference, their comorbidities, and what's going on and who exactly they are. So it kind of makes the conversation about PrEP a little bit more nuanced now than when it was just one option with Truvada. Anything to add on that, Ariel, outside of what
I would say? I agree with you. I love the slide so much, so much. Yeah. One thing I want to also draw attention to is that you visually can see that there is a shape and size difference in the pills. And for some of my patients, that has been a huge component in their decision making. And it's just something that's come up because the Truvada pill is a bit bigger and the Descovy one is smaller. And so that is another component that is offered here to consider in the conversation, along with everything else that David just reviewed so succinctly.
And be prepared for insurance companies to fight you or decline as soon as you prescribe Descovy. If someone says, oh, I saw a Descovy commercial on TV, it's the new one, let me get that. Be prepared that some insurance companies will deny that, and then you'll have to go through authorization forms correct. And other kinds of headaches after that. All right, next
Sorry,
slide, please.
And correct, yes.
So a lot of people want to know what's the laboratory monitoring? What do I have to get? How do I have to follow this? So at baseline, you're going to get a fourth generation antigen antibody test, hep B surface antigen to rule out chronic active hep B, as well as antibody testing to see if they need to be vaccinated, STI screening, RPR, triple site gonorrhea, chlamydia for your men who have sex with men. That's recommended by the CDC. But also I would encourage if you have other patients that aren't men who have sex with men, but maybe engaging in anal sex, oral sex, it may be something that you want to consider. And also hep C, a Chem7, and a urine pregnancy test. 1 month follow-up is usually an HIV fourth generation test. And every 3 months, you repeat the HIV testing, STI testing, as well as a urine pregnancy test. And then every 3 to 6 months, you're going to check a Chem7, or what a lot of people do is a spot creatinine. And of note with this, we say at the bottom with the asterisk, obtain an HIV RNA PCR viral load if you're suspicious for someone who has symptoms of acute retroviral syndrome, just to rule that out. The reason being is that you need to confirm someone is HIV negative before they start PrEP. If you have someone who's seroconverting or just recently testing positive and you just give them Truvada, that is not going to be enough to treat their HIV, and you may breed resistance if you start that medication off. Next slide, please. All right, so these are some quotes that I just wrote down. This is not scientific study or a rigorously conducted qualitative research project, but when I was working at University of Pennsylvania Student Health Center, and these were all gay men that said this, but these were quotes from some of the patients that I wrote down and just including the slide. Some patients say, I actually use condoms more now because they're aware because they have to take the pill every day. Many of them will say it gives me peace of mind. It's kind of like a safety net on top of condoms and other behavioral modifications they do to reduce their possibility of being exposed to HIV. Some of the guys said I consider it my gay vitamin. Other people said I'm not as worried if I slipped up. Again, talking about the peace of mind. And then finally, one of the things that comes up a lot, it's like birth control. Mm-hmm. And I hear that a lot. And there are parallels. Now, me, I'm not saying it is like birth control, because there are very, very distinct differences. But I think particularly for a lot of gay males, they see it as kind of the same thing. And you see some of the same stigmatization with sex shaming and shaming on people who use birth control when it first came out and then now still use birth control. You still see that among women. And I think for a lot of gay men, there are parallels with that.
I love this slide. And I would say that I've heard variations on these quotes from my patients ultimately, we're empowering our patients and we are giving them another tool to help them feel secure in themselves. I worked on the PrEP studies way back when in 2012, 2011, and watching people become more confident and not feel as scared around their sexual lives was incredible. So yes to all of this.
Yeah, and I will say this. I have heard as an internal medicine doc, a lot of patients said that they didn't always talk about this stuff, or for some reason they didn't bring it up to their OBGYN docs. And I didn't understand why. I have a feeling there's a lot of dynamics that may be going on with time, number of patients needed to be seen. But I think some patients are wanting to talk about it with their GYN docs, but may not know. And sometimes that confusion leads to people just shutting down and not wanting to talk about it. But when they start taking it, like Ariel said, it's very much an empowering thing for them with regards to their sexual health. Next slide, please. Okay, this is about the price again. This is an older slide from about 2013. And as you can see with capitalism and pricing, it's gone up from $1,425 we mentioned earlier to $1,900 that you'd have for either Truvada or Descovy. I will mention on the left side of this slide, the cost. Most insurance companies, you can expect your patients to have a copay of maybe $50 a month. With generic Truvada, it may be a 0% copay. And there is a website, I'll reference this a little bit later, but Gilead has a website called Advancing Access, which helps if you have patients who are uninsured or underinsured, which is more common that we see here, that you can help them get a copay card or you can help them with financial assistance to get it so they have nothing out of pocket that they have to pay when they pick up their prescriptions.
And at this point, that program is only for Descovy. It's no longer available for Truvada.
No longer for Truvada, correct. All right, next slide. All right, I will mention this. This is called the Ipergay study. This is a study, you may have patients who aren't sexually active frequently and who plan out their sexual episodes. And so Ipergay was a study that was done in Europe, in France in particular, and it's basically event-driven PrEP. So as you can see here, and the cute graphics are here that you can see where you have the two yellow faces, that's where people are having sex, that little area right there. So the goal is when you take PrEP, instead of taking it every day, you take two tablets, and again, this study was done with TDF and FTC or Truvada versus placebo. This hasn't been fully studied with Descovy yet, or we don't have results yet, just yet. But it's 2 to 24 hours before sex, you take two pills, and then one tablet 24 hours after sex, and then another tablet 48 hours after sex. And what they found in these studies, and this again was with men who have sex with men, there was an 86% HIV risk reduction with on-demand PrEP. It is not FDA approved for this method, but is being prescribed by an option. What I would say to you that since it's off label, have the discussion with your patients. I know a lot of clinicians who are prescribing it this way in the United States because it fits their patient's profile better. But just understand that it is not FDA approved for this indication or in this manner just yet. Anything else, Ariel, on that?
I agree with your framing around it being something that does fit their patient profile more. It's also far more cost effective. And that is a huge drive for a lot of people who I know are using it this way, because the medication lasts longer.
Absolutely. And
depending on, in conjunction with their sexual profile. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've had people tell me, like, who schedules or plans out sex? And then I have a lot of other patients that are like, I do. Like, yeah, it's me.
Exactly.
I don't have sex every day. I'm not having sex multiple times a week. So for those kind of patients, again, we have to tailor our approaches to PrEP to that. Next slide.
100%.
All right. The South accounted for more than half of all new HIV diagnoses in the U.S. in 2016. I would extrapolate that and say the data is the same for 2019, yet only 30% of the PrEP users. Next slide. So we're not using PrEP in the areas that are needed. We do know, this slide is just talking about not enough healthcare providers know about PrEP. So we know that it's 90% effective of reducing sexually acquired HIV, and that could be anywhere from 90 to 100%, 70% effective in reducing risk of HIV among IV drug users, people who use IV drugs. Unfortunately, this percentage goes down to 33% or 1 in 3, where you talk about primary care doctors and nurses actually hearing about PrEP. There have been studies that have shown that we don't know about PrEP. So while patients may know about it, obviously the insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies know about it, but the rate limiting step in this equation tends to be us as primary care providers. Next slide. Just a note, and I think the take home of this message, I do a lot of work with Black MSM, and so we've been prescribing PrEP for them for ages. There have been studies showing that Black MSM have been unaware of PrEP. They have lower rates of HIV testing knowledge, fewer HIV testing experiences, and higher rates of transactional sex. But there was also an interesting study where they took med students and had mock patients. And what you saw was that depending on the race of the patient, the students made assumptions. So when medical students were actually took through these mock patients and said, well, would you prescribe PrEP? They rated the Black patients as more likely than the white patients to engage in condomless sex if they prescribed PrEP. And that translated to the medical students saying they were less willing to prescribe PrEP to Black patients. I say all this to say you may not have a high percentage of men who have sex with men or Black people in your practice, but check your bias. And Ariel mentioned this earlier. So check your bias with regards to judgment. Check your bias with regards to who you're assuming will use or not use condoms if you give PrEP. If a patient tells you they need PrEP and then they tell you they're using condoms 100%, some providers would say, well, why you need PrEP if you're using condoms 100% of the time? Think about it this way. They may be telling you that they use condoms 100% of the time because they think that's what you want them to say, or that's what you want to hear, but they may actually be putting themselves more at risk than they'll let on to you because they're not comfortable or they've been shamed before. So if a patient says, hey, I'm interested in PrEP, I think it would be helpful for my sexual health, believe them and talk with them, have the counseling, and then prescribe it for them. Ariel, I know you want to comment on this.
I would also add to that, we can't assume sexual orientation or sexual monogamy in anyone that we engage with in a clinical setting. And unless you are taking a comprehensive sexual health history, you are not getting the information that you need to give the full directive around what they might need for their sexual health.
Absolutely. Okay, next slide. So, you know, people are wondering, how do I implement a PrEP program? There is no kind of quote unquote how to develop a PrEP program, but there are guidelines that you can follow and things that you need to consider. First, identify a clinical leader for the program, someone that's really going to be passionate and driven about incorporating this into your space. And again, don't think about PrEP as a pill, either Truvada or Descovy. Think of it as a sexual health program or empowerment program with that. Implement an HIV PrEP protocol. Ariel's going to be very humble about this, but she was involved in the American College Health Association HIV PrEP guidelines. They have samples. So go to ACHA's website. They have a wonderful PrEP guideline white paper that kind of describes and breaks down everything you need to know about this. And also understand that probably by the end of, or actually probably soon, it was supposed to be at the end of the summer, the CDC was going to bring out new guidelines. So keep your eyes open for that, because that should be coming up soon. And then develop timelines for follow-up visits and scheduled labs. Telehealth is a great tool for PrEP follow-up. All right, next slide. Some other considerations. Decide whether you want to integrate PrEP just into the general clinical practice, so it'll be included as visits with everybody else, or if you want it to be standalone, like say, hey, we have a PrEP clinic and advertise it like that. That is something you have to determine in your clinic and with your patient population. Pharmacy collaborations and leaderships have been found to be tremendously effective. So if you're saying as a provider, oh, I don't know if I have time, I don't know if I can do that. If you do have a pharmacy that you trust, a pharmacy on site, speak with the pharmacist. Some of them may be passionate about this stuff and want to lead this drive as well. For your electronic medical records, it's always a good idea to include smart sets that just with a click of the button, you'll get what labs to do on the initial visit, on the follow-up visits, what testing to do, what medications, how to order them, which pharmacy to send it to. You can put all those things in, so it makes it really, really easy for you to go through, even if you don't feel comfortable with it. And then marketing, emphasis on PrEP and sexual health instead of talking about, are you at risk or trying to scare people that they need this. If you just talk in more affirming language, it may be helpful. Any comments on that, Ariel? Anything else to add?
Just that I incorporate it very easily into any sexual health visit. I just mention it, ask about it, promote it, and it just sort of streamlined with any STI visit at this point. And it's a good tactic too.
All right, next slide. All right, just for your information, the NIH is actually moving forward with other types of long-acting HIV prevention. So what we just discussed with two oral medications is going to expound into a lot more delivery systems. So you have intravaginal rings, implants, injectable use as well, which is actually probably going to be FDA approved at the beginning of 2022, there's a medication called cabotegravir that you can give an injection every 2 months that is just as effective, if not more effective, than the oral pills. And then also antibodies being infused or injected into the body. And as similar with COVID-19, people don't always know this, but a lot of the mRNA research was already being done with HIV. And when COVID-19 hit, they had to drop the work with HIV and target it towards COVID-19. So now that we know that the mRNA vaccine technology can work, these scientists are going back. So I would expect to see something in the next 5 to 10 years. And I think some of these trials are already underway. So it'll be interesting, and it's exciting to see these different delivery systems of PrEP coming about.
Very exciting.
All right, next slide. All right, some additional resources: AIDS, AIDSEducationTrainingCenter.org, CDC.gov, PrEPLocator.org, Gilead Advancing Access. Again, like Ariel said, they're going to be helping out with Descovy, but not Truvada because it is generic now. Any other resources you would drive folks to?
We mentioned the ACHA website, and I think these are, I think these are good. Yeah.
Okay. All right, next slide. And of course, the OBG Project website is going to be good because we have tiles and they also have other sections on PrEP as well. So in summation, PrEP requires great history, sexual history taking. It's an effective HIV prevention option and program. I want to emphasize that. The medical profession, we can do a lot more, and it's really on us to kind of drive this bus. Those sexual health conversations don't always start with the patients because they feel a little bit intimidated and uncomfortable bringing it up. But just know that you can incorporate PrEP anywhere. So whether you're working in a county clinic, a private clinic, wherever you are, you can start to open up these conversations about sexual health and PrEP wherever you're at. Next slide. And I think that's it. So we've left a few minutes for discussion, questions. If there are any questions, I don't know, Ashley, if you're fielding some of these or you've seen any. It would be great if you have any questions, we're happy to answer in the time we have left.
Great. Well, I just wanted to say, first off, thank you for this really comprehensive overview. And I think all of those resources are a great way for people to learn more. I would just love to kind of in our final minutes, see if you have any, one big key takeaway point for people that may be interested but are a little hesitant about kind of starting that whole process. Is there anything that you have learned or have that you've incorporated that have made it a little bit easier? I know that, Ariel, you already mentioned kind of just talking about it in the sexual history, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. Is it okay if I go first, David? I would say be very aware of starting small and taking your time developing the program. And it doesn't need to be a full force marketing run through that everyone's on board immediately. You can start small and be aware of what your capacity is. And another thing too, we didn't actually mention this earlier, is that there are great opportunities for RN driven programs, nurse driven programs, to be supported by nurse practitioners, PAs, MDs, DOs beyond that space. A lot of programs that I know that are very successful, the follow-up is done by RN driven programs, and it's incredibly successful. So those are my initial thoughts.
Yeah, I would agree, and just add on to that. I think it's something where if you have a core group of people, if you identify two or three people, I remember when I worked at UPenn Student Health Center, there was myself, a nurse practitioner, and another nurse that we were all very passionate about it. We sat down with the IT person and literally just took some of our administration time and carved out the electronic medical record smart sets to put that in so that anybody could do it. Because we had a lot of providers there, but all of them weren't familiar with it. But we were trying to make it easy. You do have to have leadership buy-in. So speak to whoever the medical director is, who the head of your clinic is, and just emphasize that to see if you can carve out a little bit of time. They can give you some extra administrative time to do this. That would be helpful. You can also talk about how to, depending on how your billing goes and how your visits are constructed, making sure those sexual health visits or those PrEP visits are at least 30 minutes, because you're going to have a lot of conversations and a lot of counseling that you have to do, particularly on that initial visit. And then you can incorporate follow-ups with telehealth, utilize other medical assistants, nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs, pharmacists, even community peer liaisons helps out a lot as well. So if you have some peer leaders that are passionate about empowerment with sexual health, definitely get them involved in the construction of your program and also the implementation of it as you move forward.
Great. And just one last question I think we have time for. So one of our attendees noted that levels are detectable in serum and other bodily fluids at different timelines, but when do you tell patients that they're considered to be therapeutic? Like, does it depend on the body part used or based upon some therapeutic serum level? Kind of how do we unpack that?
Such a good question. So you are correct. It does take different times to get into different parts of the body. And so the general guidance I give for it to be at a therapeutic level is about 3 weeks, 21 days. What do you say, David?
Yeah, I tell people it takes 3 days also to get out of the system. They still have detectable levels 3 days out. But what they'll say is that with rectal tissue and the serum, it's about 7 days.
Yes.
But with vaginal tissue, they'll say 20 to 21 days. Now, I think, you know, Ariel, your approach is great because you kind of cover that just in case. The thing is that a lot of patients want this now and want to start and are planning to have sex like the next day or the day after that. And so they want it to kind of ramp up. So it's important to counsel them through that. And then also when you have studies like the Ipergay study, like I just mentioned, that shows that even when you take it on demand, as needed, when you're having a sexual encounter, that it still is effective, 86% reduction, you're thinking to yourself, well, those are contrasting messages that we're giving. We're saying it takes that long to get into the system, but obviously it may confer some protection early on. So you have to really have these conversations and also be honest that it may not be certain, but to stay on the safe side, I would give it more than just a day or two to kind of get in before you know.
Yeah, and a big part of this too is really honing in on adherence and really helping people. A lot of folks are starting a habit, a daily pill habit for the first time. And how are they setting up that routine? Certainly in my population, there are lots of different body parts are being used for sexual contact. And so yes, generally that is generally the guidance. But yes, to David's point, getting into the more nuance about what is actually happening sexually is vital.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you both. All of these resources are really, really great. We will have them available on the website. And also just to highlight, Fenway Health Center also has some great modules for people that are interested in learning more. And thank you all for joining us. We will see you next month on October 29th to switch gears back to obstetrics and talk about some of the current changes in late preterm steroids and antenatal steroids. But thank you so much for joining us this month.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.